Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We have an anniversary looming as we speak, the 21st year since our nation was attacked on what's come to now be known universally as 9/11. The perpetrators, 19 of them, are people we now are told we're supposed to describe as violent extremists. Or maybe not even that. Terrorists came and went, but certainly we're not allowed to call them what they were, which is Sharia supremacists who, by virtue of that Islamic code, were, I think, persuaded Allah meant for them to engage in holy war or jihad against the infidels. And they did, with murderous effects, the worst attack on U.S. soil in our nation's history. We've been very fortunate that it has not been replicated or even worse. That's due in part thanks to the hard work of people like our first guest. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. He is no stranger to this program. Indeed, he is a regular of it, for which we're very grateful, as we are for his service to our country in a variety of capacities, notably for some 20 years following 9/11 as an undercover operative, much of his time spent in Sharia supremacist countries, battling jihadists and their enablers. We're very grateful to him for all of that, as we are for his continuing service to the nation, notably in his current capacity as the driving force behind a terrific online resource, andmagazine.com, which I encourage you to follow at Substack. Sam Faddis, welcome on this very somber day, on the eve of this terrible, terrible moment in our nation's history. The anniversary thereof. Tell us a little bit about your own life experience of 9/11 and its aftermath.
Well, thanks for having me, Frank. I worked counterterrorism throughout my career, and in the run-up, I mean, in the years prior to 9/11, I had been working terrorism for a long time, along with a number of other individuals. So, you know, 9/11 was a surprise attack in the sense that we did not have, or certainly had not analyzed and appreciated, the specific intelligence that would allow us to say, on this date, at this time, in this manner, we're going to be hit. It was not a surprise in any way to anybody who had been working counterterrorism, in the sense that we are going to be hit. In fact, we have already been hit multiple times, and we will continue to be hit. And the intention of the enemy, which, as you noted, is Islamic extremism, is crystal clear. They have been shouting it from the rooftops and the minarets for years. And as I said, they've already blown up two of our embassies. They've already, by this point in time, almost sunk the USS Cole. They have innumerable other plots working, some of which, you know, we have managed to fend off. So in that sense, there was no surprise at all. We're not doing anything about it. We're watching and allowing the enemy to gain strength
and take encouragement from our passivity in the face of these serial attacks.
There were members of Al Qaeda who, after 9/11, when we began to finally put hands on people, who said things like, "When you responded to such an attack by firing Tomahawk missiles at an empty hillside in Afghanistan, we knew you were impotent and we could do whatever we wanted." There was no ambiguity about the encouragement they took. It was very explicit. We allowed them to gain strength. Of course, the problem, the real issue now is we are doing it again, right? We are repeating the mistake right now.
Yes, we are. Only in a way, it's vastly worse, as we've discussed from time to time, Sam, in the sense that not only in the intervening period have we been induced, I personally think primarily by Muslim Brotherhood influence operations, to avert our gaze, or certainly, you know, remake our lexicon so we wouldn't give offense to anybody who is an Islamist or Sharia supremacist, it seems to me more accurate. And I just have to say, Sam, even the term Islamic extremist is misleading, I think, mm-hmm. because these are people who follow what is the core tenet of Islam. Fortunately, I think large numbers of Muslims around the world don't, including in this country. But it's not so clear to me that they're the extremists who do. And what they have in mind, as you said, whether it's shouted from the minarets or in the mosques or really in most other public settings, at least for their own people's consumption, is it is Allah's will that you fight to establish the caliphate or otherwise conquer the world. So in your own life experience, Sam, you've seen what happens when we fail to understand, let alone respond appropriately to jihadism. When you look at a country now that has, heavens only knows how many jihadists in our midst, but as we've discussed again, many, many of them imported by us at our expense with no questions asked from Afghanistan, the very place where 9/11, of course, was launched. It's just mind-boggling. That we think we're not due for a much bigger problem in this country in the days to come. Tell me I'm wrong.
No, unfortunately, you're not wrong. I mean, look, this is about as clear-cut and straightforward and commonsensical as one could imagine. The gates are wide open. The walls are unmanned. The fact that you as an American at this point in history, find it uncomfortable to view things through these expressly religious lenses. Okay, that's fine. But that's not true of your enemy. Your enemy does look at the world that way, and they are not seeking accommodation. They don't want you to just leave them alone. The entire basis of Al-Qaeda's, its entire premise is the war on the far enemy, the bringing the war here, the destruction of the infidels. Paint this any way you want. And I would just say, as I've said to you many times before, 9/11 was never intended to be as bad as it will get. That was not the end state. That was an attack and a good start as far as they were concerned. Atomic weapons, chemical weapons, biological weapons, every horror you can imagine, and some probably you can't, not just a dream, they were physically working on making it reality when we went into Afghanistan. Now they are back, bigger, better, more powerful than ever. Yeah. So what comes
not,
next?
Not least with a whole arsenal full of our own weapons.
Yes.
Some of which could conceivably be used as delivery systems for the kinds of weapons of mass destruction that you've talked about. Sam, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about what we're looking at instead of this enemy. We're not even getting to the Chinese, but just even the jihadists. Instead, we seem to be focusing, at least Joe Biden and his team are, on us. We're going to talk about the othering of MAGA Republicans and a great many other Americans with Sam Faddis right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Sunday is the 21st anniversary of the most murderous attack on U.S. soil ever. Regrettably, we have largely reverted to our pre-9/11 inattention, to the Sharia supremacist sentiments that impelled that day's events, even as we have been put at risk of vastly worse jihadism in the intervening period. Indeed, thanks substantially to Islamist influence operations over the past two decades, too few of us properly perceive that danger. Our government has been reduced to using misleading euphemisms like violent extremists instead of understanding and properly addressing the holy war that Islam's Sharia code demands of its adherents. Team Biden actually insists that MAGA Republicans and Christian nationalists are now the greatest domestic threat. 19 jihadists perpetrated 9/11. Many thousands of unaccompanied military-aged men, including Taliban-tied ones, are now inside and all over our country. What can possibly go wrong? Plenty. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We're continuing a conversation that is, as is often the case, both grim, but also a call to action, really, from one of our great warriors, an undercover one for much of his career, as well as an army officer prior to that. His name is Sam Faddis, a longtime undercover clandestine services officer in the Central Intelligence Agency. And Sam, you participated in a program of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, which I'm very proud to say you are a member, last Wednesday. And it was extremely impressive, but also deeply troubling to hear you and others in this webinar discussing the Biden team's othering of tens of millions, if not actually over 100 million Americans, as domestic terrorists, as enemies of the state, as people who are beyond the pale. Because why? Because they embrace our Constitution, because they deny our election outcome in 2020 because they have followed or support Donald Trump and similar reasons. It is deeply alarming that they would be characterized as anything other than law-abiding, patriotic Americans, let alone in these terrible terms. But much worse yet, as we've discussed on previous occasions, and I would ask you to reflect on, informed by, among other things, this webinar, the fact that the Biden administration is mobilizing, marshaling the agencies of our government to treat all those millions of Americans as indeed the enemies, the dangerous, the most dangerous foe we face, instead of the one we were just talking about, for example. Where does this leave us, Sam, at this moment, do you think?
I think the unfortunate reality, Frank, is it leaves us in completely uncharted waters. And this is the, I know you and I keep coming back to this every time we talk about this issue, get anywhere close to it, but where we are now is someplace we have never been before. In our lifetimes, we have never seen anything like this. I'm not sure we've ever seen anything like this in American history. This is not just about overheated rhetoric or bad PR or however you want to spin it. This is the essence of what I think the American people need to really, they need to understand and grab a hold of. And I think they just kind of recoil at the notion and don't want to grasp it. All bets are off. We've broken all the rules. This administration is the most radical in American history. It is filled with revolutionaries, and I use that term very explicitly as a guy who has fought the communist revolution his whole life. And they, when you talk about weaponizing law enforcement, intelligence, and so forth, yes, and they have already done it. And they are in control of the powers of the state. And they, so this is all very done very expressly. When they look at the MAGA movement, whatever terminology you want to use, and they start referring to them as enemies of the state and domestic violent extremists, they use words precisely as all Marxists do. This is done to establish the foundation to justify the use of the power of the state against you. It is happening all around us, right? Steve Bannon being perp walked yesterday. Okay. I don't know the details of the specific case, but the point is, this has nothing to do with a specific case other than silencing him, parading him in handcuffs in front of cameras to say to the American people, his real crime is he opposes us and you're next. That this is the reality where we are. And I get it, the American people don't want to face that because it's terrifying and it's disgusting, but it's very, very real.
Sam, as we discussed in our webinar, and by the way, people can get access to this at presentdangerchina.org, and I really urge you to view this particular webinar, but all of them really, but this one was especially compelling and I think especially timely. And you can find them at presentdangerchina.org, as I say. When you talked about this the other day, Sam, we all agreed that the corrective of choice is the one that now, theoretically at least, looms, namely an election, a midterm election where people could vote not, to replace the president, but to change the balance of power in Washington by turning over the Congress to Republican majorities, House and Senate, perhaps. One of the upshots, though, of our conversation was a sentiment that was expressed by several of our panelists that for all the reasons you've just described, the uncharted territory we're in, the overheated rhetoric, yes, but worse, the weaponizing of the instruments of state power against these putative enemies could result in action that would either preclude altogether or at least interrupt, postpone, defer these elections themselves, thereby essentially foreclosing that option. You've been spending a lot of time, to your great credit, Sam, in your native Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, trying to advance the cause of election integrity. And you're an unsung hero in that regard. I know you've been working with a large team, and God bless you for doing so. But talk about the possibility that not only do we continue to see the real danger in Pennsylvania and elsewhere that we will have these elections stolen, it's my way of thinking, again, as they were in 2020, but they might even be essentially dispensed with altogether, at least for a time.
Well, first of all, when you talk about what happened in 2020, there is no question that there was massive electoral theft. You don't have to believe in Bigfoot or anything else, right? This is all about facts. And when you are shouted down and told that you are a conspiracy theorist, if you raise that issue, that
A big
again is a
lie.
very, that's a very deliberate tactic. It is designed to make you afraid to raise these issues because you will be demonized and attacked. So this is transparent, it's deliberate, it's very, very old school. So are we going to see theft again going into the next election cycle in Pennsylvania? Almost certainly, because we have not actually fixed any of the problems from 2 years ago, remarkable as that may seem. But as you've suggested, at a national level, looking against this backdrop of where we are with the Biden administration, can anybody really tell me that it is beyond the pale, unthinkable, that Joe Biden appears on television and says, because of those dangerous MAGA people and all these threats to the electoral process, we're not going to have elections until we deal with this issue? And just, I mean, I really think that's not science fiction. It could happen tomorrow. And in the blink of an eye, all of a sudden you will realize, oh, we don't actually have a democracy anymore. Now,
or a constitutional republic, more to the point. Yeah,
we don't have any of that. We have a dictatorship, a totalitarian regime, and we're going the same road as God knows how many third world countries have gone before. Elections have been suspended. I'll let you know when I feel like stepping down, if I do. And we're there in a heartbeat.
And you will have no recourse, but no. For ones that I don't think any of us relish or advocate. But
exactly.
They may be driving us to that. And I think, frankly, that is their purpose, is to provoke a violent response, which would justify not just the crackdown they have in mind, but also perhaps suspending our constitutional republic's electoral processes. God forbid any of this happens. Sam Faddis, I know it will be, despite your best efforts, if it is so. Thanks for your time today. Come back to us again soon, if you would. Chuck DeVore is up next, right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Back, I'm very pleased to say, joined by a colleague who has also been devoting his life to the service of our country in the uniform of the United States Army, through whose ranks he rose to the position of Lieutenant Colonel. He has been a very active contributor in other ways, notably as an assemblyman in California legislature for 6 years, and these days as the vice president for national initiatives at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. His name is Chuck DeVore. We're always pleased to have him with us. Colonel, welcome back to Securing America.
Great to be back with you, Frank.
I've got a couple of things I want to talk to you about and not a lot of time to do it in, so let's get right to it. One of the things that I know you have been working on, both in your former capacity in the state legislature of California and since, is drawing the right lessons from the kinds of decisions that California has taken. There's now put it in deep kimchi, I guess they say in Korea, with respect to energy. Your native state of Texas now has got some problems in that department as well, for similar reasons, an over-reliance, it seems, on renewables instead of those ready and reliable sources of baseload power. Talk us through that, if you would.
Right. So the two largest states have arrived at a similar position, albeit for different reasons. In California, it was because of ideology driven by concerns over climate change. And in Texas, it's because of market considerations. You have very heavy federal subsidies. The market operators in Texas want to take advantage of that. And a lot of large corporations, of course, like the Post, that they have net zero. In other words, they're not using much in the way of carbon dioxide emissions. And so what's happening in both states is the power grid is becoming increasingly vulnerable to these periodic outages due to a lack of supply at critical times. In California, it's pretty predictable because California is very heavily weighted towards solar power, whereas Texas so far is very heavily weighted toward wind power, which is a lot less reliable, of course. So in California's case, what happens is as the sun starts to go down in the afternoon, people start to come home and they turn on their air conditioners and they charge their Teslas. And the grid is under tremendous strain. They have what's called a duck curve, which simply means if you look at the curve, it kind of looks like the back of a duck. And what happens is every day at around 4:30 to 5 o'clock, they start to get really tight in their electrical supplies. And Frank, the problem is that while California is connected to the Western Interconnection, as I recall, about 13 states and parts of Canada and Mexico and, of course, California, what's happening is California's policies are beginning to affect the economics of their adjacent states as well. And so it really is discouraging the creation of baseload power. And they're really not serious about nuclear power, Frank, which is, if they were truly concerned about the climate, they would be much more enthusiastic about nuclear power.
Well, which is all the more, I think, bizarre, because simultaneously, Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, is saying everybody in California is going to have a, or at least everybody who wants to drive, is going to have an electric-powered vehicle by some point in the near future. They can't charge the ones they've got now under the present regimen as that power spike starts up, or demand spike starts up. So, Chuck, I want to move on to another topic with you, but it does seem to me as though one of the takeaways from the California experience for Texas and others is get back to basics, and base load power is critical for that purpose.
Right.
Let me pivot, though, to this second topic, which I know you've been also spending a lot of time on. There is going on in Ukraine an counteroffensive now by the Ukrainian military, much of it made possible, I suppose, by armaments they've received from us and the Europeans. But to their credit, they're taking the fight to the Russians, not simply being pounded by them in a defensive crouch. What does that portend, as you see it, first of all, for Putin? What do you think might be his next move? And second of all, what are the takeaways from what we've been watching happen in Ukraine for people who have in mind a similar act of aggression against Taiwan, namely communist China?
Right. So the Ukrainian counteroffensive right now appears to be very successful. They've been forcing Russia to reposition troops to the south opposite Kherson by the Dnipro River. That terrain, Frank, is very difficult. It's very marshy, and it's actually easier to traverse much of it during the hard winter when it freezes up. So they've been grinding away and forcing the Russians to redeploy their very thin reserves. And what's happened is, perhaps unexpectedly, certainly unexpectedly, it appears to the Russians, the Ukrainians launched a very rapid counteroffensive to the east of Kharkiv in the region of Kupiansk. And what's happened is it appears they've severed the key rail supply lines down to Izium, thus threatening a pretty large Russian force with either being pocketing or certainly being cut off. So it's a very well-executed counteroffensive. I think the lessons learned for China vis-a-vis Taiwan, and I wrote about this about a week or so ago, and I think that these lessons are heightened by this action, is the first lesson is, don't go in. If you're going to invade, go in with everything you have. Don't expect that your enemy is going to fold like Putin did of the Ukrainians. And of course, I thought that Putin had lost his strategic objective within 24 hours of his launching the invasion, because the government in Kyiv didn't fall. So number one, go in with everything you have. Number two,
despite Joe Biden's efforts to persuade,
exactly,
to move to other parts,
exactly, with Zelensky declaring, "I need ammo, not a ride." Right, that's a very Churchillian moment in Ukrainian history. So the second thing is, when the information war, when the communications war dominates, what happened again from the start is Ukraine had a very significant advantage over Russia in getting their message out to the world and presenting a very sympathetic face. Now, of course, that's easy if you're seen as the victim and Russia is seen as the aggressor. But nevertheless, everyone expected that Russia would be able to jam Ukraine's internet and other access. And I think in this case, of course, Elon Musk's Starlink donation was a significant benefit, not only in the communications war, of course, but also in tactical communications to help coordinate and fight. And I think the last thing to, the last big lesson learned is don't assume that your adversary is not going to have friends. So in the case of Putin invading Ukraine, I think he figured that he would have it over so quickly and he would cow the Europeans that were adjacent to Ukraine so mightily that no one would help, that Ukraine would be isolated and lost to their own devices. And so in the case of Taiwan versus China, that forces China to consider perhaps at the onset of any conflict, that Japan and America would be involved in the fight. And I think for that reason, it's reasonable for us to expect that significant Chinese action directed against our forces in the region would happen at the very moment of the attack. So Okinawa and Guam and of course, Japanese naval assets would likely be in the crosshairs, I think, from the very first minute of the operation.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And we've been talking this up a lot on this program, Chuck. Assets, personnel, and territory of the United States are almost certainly going to be, in fact, as you say, in the crosshairs, targeted and struck probably by Chinese forces in order to minimize the chances that anything goes sideways. A very important takeaway. The other, just to come back to it, because I think it's very noteworthy, there are reported recommendations being made within China to take out Musk's Starlink system. And that's presumably in part because, as you say, it has proven to be a workaround for countering efforts to exercise information dominance, which is a big part of the fight, you know, who's right. Getting their message out. The other piece of it, though, Chuck, as you know, as a former military officer, it has these decided tactical and maybe even strategic values as well. And so we might well find something that is deemed to be important to making our own space assets and capabilities more resilient would be targeted in this Chinese attack on Taiwan and other parts. Would you agree?
I would agree. And I also think it's high time that we very much clarify what an attack on U.S. space assets would mean. I think we've kind of maintained, at least in my opinion, something akin to strategic ambiguity. I mean, what would happen if, for example, some key satellites were disabled or destroyed? What does that mean? Is that an effective declaration of war or not? What would we do? And so I think it's very important to lay down the markers that this will not be tolerated.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more about that as well, Chuck. But I also have to point out, it escaped my attention at the time, and unfortunately, perhaps others as well. Kamala Harris, back in April, announced a unilateral suspension of our direct ascent tests of anti-satellite capabilities. Now, I don't know that we had any in mind anyway, and I think they were dressing this up as another green initiative where you don't want to have space littered with this junk. But the truth of the matter is that can be interpreted as, and I think probably in this administration would operate as an example of unilateral disarmament at a very moment when we want to make sure we've got the capabilities to hold at risk other people's space assets. Chuck, we're out of time. I wish I had an opportunity to hear your response to that, but I hope you'll come back soon and let's discuss all of this further. Thank you for the work you do at the Texas Public Policy Foundation and for joining us from time to time. Next up, more on China with Dr. Bradley Thayer, author of Understanding the China Threat, right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Sunday is the 21st anniversary of the most murderous attack on U.S. soil ever. Regrettably, we have largely reverted to our pre-9/11 inattention, to the Sharia supremacist sentiments that impelled that day's events, even as we have been put at risk of vastly worse jihadism in the intervening period. Indeed, thanks substantially to Islamist influence operations over the past two decades, too few of us properly perceive that danger. Our government has been reduced to using misleading euphemisms like violent extremists instead of understanding and properly addressing the holy war that Islam's Sharia code demands of its adherents. Team Biden actually insists that MAGA Republicans and Christian nationalists are now the greatest domestic threat. 19 jihadists perpetrated 9/11. Many thousands of unaccompanied military-age men, including Taliban-tied ones, are now inside and all over our country. What can possibly go wrong? Plenty. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and we're joined by one of our most accomplished and appreciated colleagues and resources when it comes to the ultimate threat to our country, beyond what we've been talking about that we're doing to ourselves, and that is the Chinese Communist Party. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. I'm very pleased to say these days he is the director of the China Projects at the Center for Security Policy, my colleague there. He's also the author of a number of important books, including a forthcoming one that can be ordered now, entitled Understanding the Threat, which he has co-authored with another member of our Committee on the Present Danger China, as is Brad Thayer, Lianqiao Han. Brad, it's great to have you back. Welcome and congratulations once again on the book coming out at the end of this month. We're looking forward to a deep dive with you as soon as it's available, but we'll touch on some aspects of it, I know, in the course of this conversation. It's always good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. It's my pleasure.
So we have now in prospect two things. One, I believe, war with the Chinese Communist Party. And I don't mean the unrestricted warfare. I don't mean, you know, rhetorical warfare, you know, people's war. I mean the old-fashioned kind, kinetic war. That seems, based on both my own assessment and that of a number of our guests, to be distinctly possible, if not probable, in the not-too-distant future. The other, which we haven't had a chance to talk about since it was announced last week, I believe, is the coming People's Congress now has a date set for it, the 16th of October. I'm very keen to get your take, Brad, on how these two events or phenomena, if you will, are intersecting with one another and what that might mean for, well, us, most especially.
Certainly, Frank. There is a strong connection between them. The risks of a kinetic war, as you described, rightfully noting that we've been at war with the CCP since its inception, it's coming to power in 1949, and that war takes many forms, ideological, cyber, essentially the economic warfare, but the kinetic is the one obviously to focus on because of the consequences, immediate consequences of that, which would be very dramatic. After the 20th Party Congress, which as you noted begins October 16th, we should expect that the likelihood of conflict greatly increases, and that is that Xi will be risk avoiding before the 20th Congress, and he's going to be risk accepting after the conclusion of the 20th Party Congress, where I think it's quite reasonable to expect that he'll be essentially coronated. He'll receive his third term, and thus we should expect him to be in power, obviously, as long as he's alive, again, a 69-year-old man. So it's quite likely he's going to remain in power for a decade and a half, realistically.
Wow. this 69-year-old man has ambitions to be not just the permanent leader of communist China, but to be effectively the dominant figure in the world as well. And for that to be accomplished, Brad, it seems likely that they will need at some point to use force, to coerce, to compel submission to communist China. We have been, as you know, warning of late, in particular in the form of our book, The CCP is at War with America, about a kind of hybrid, if you will, between the unrestricted, non-kinetic kind of warfare and the kinetic kind, namely biological warfare, which we believe was unleashed by Xi Jinping against our country 2 years ago. When you look at that, almost 3 years ago now, when you look at that, Brad, and I know you cover this in your new book, Understanding the China Threat, in a chapter you've dedicated to the risk-taking character of Xi Jinping, is it your assessment that after the coronation, once he is secured, with Joe Biden in the White House, with Europe and other parts of the world distracted and in turmoil over Ukraine, among other things, and droughts and famines and the like, energy issues, that he will find it not only, you know, possible, but absolutely irresistible to go after not just Taiwan, not just against, you know, Japan, but against us as well, our assets, our personnel, and our territory, perhaps as well, presumably after the Party Congress.
I think that's right, Frank. And I think so for two reasons. First, domestically, he'll have his house in order. That is, that he will have what he wanted from the 20th Party Congress, and he's going to have, perhaps to some degree, it might be begrudging, but he's going to have the backing from the party and control of the party, which is essential for the internal politics of China. So we should think that his domestic house is in order. Secondly, as you observe, he has a window of opportunity. The Biden administration is weak in terms of the measures that should have been taken to have a robust deterrent, conventional and strategic deterrent, to deter Chinese aggression. We don't have that. So he has his domestic house.
Brad, hold the thought. I hate to interrupt you, but we do have to take a hard break here. I want to just say, I think it's worse than we're weak at the moment under Joe Biden, and we'll talk about what else is going on there on the other side of this very short break with Bradley Thayer, the author of the forthcoming book, Understanding the China Threat. I must read. Get it now by pre-order at Amazon. We'll be right back with more. Dr. Bradley Thayer is in the house, I'm very pleased to say, virtually. He is a colleague of mine at the Center for Security Policy, where he directs our China project. He is also an accomplished author and essayist, most notably at the moment, the author of a forthcoming, really important book, Understanding the China Threat. Brad, you were just talking about calculations for Xi Jinping about the United States and the window of opportunity that he may see to act violently to accomplish, you know, the, if I can use the expression, great leap forward towards world domination that he seeks. And you mentioned that he perceives Joe Biden as weak, and I'm concerned that it's considerably worse than that. If he considers him to be, well, weak, yes, but also compromised, a man who is now so deeply, well, at the mercy, really, of the Chinese Communist Party because of what his son and what he have done for them, with them, in the past, and arguably even today. It creates, well, as I say, an irresistible temptation to move against us, I fear. Would you agree or disagree?
I would agree with that. Again, he has that window of opportunity. Biden will, well, we don't know how long Biden will be president, but we should, it's quite reasonable to expect that he'll be in power for at least another 2 years. And that gives, as you observe, Frank, that gives in Xi Jinping's calculus a time to act when he's not going to have a strong U.S. leader pushing back against him. He's not going to have a leader on the American side in conjunction with allies who are going to have the right force structure, who are going to have the right capabilities, and who are not just pushing back against him, but targeting the CCP and its misrule of China, which is in fact what we should be doing. We have none of that with Biden. So he does have a window. And it's quite likely, again, he's going to be risk accepting. That is, he's far more likely to gamble that he's going to be able to act and get away with it in terms of aggression, certainly against Taiwan, because we do not have, again, the right capabilities in the area and on Taiwan itself, but also against Guam, against other U.S. interests in the Indo-Pacific and globally. And of course, domestically, an aspect, as you have noted time and again, that the CCP is hollowing out the United States through a host of measures, the biological attacks, the fentanyl, and we're seeing the consequences of that.
And the economic warfare, among other things, as well as elite capture. Brad, I want to switch gears, but let me just say, I'm concerned personally that the window may be shorter and closer, that especially if Biden's condition continues to deteriorate and popularity with it. And also, if we're lucky, there are elections and the elections result in a repudiation of him and control switching over to Republicans in the Congress. Xi may feel the time to strike is before the new Congress is seated. So watch this space. We'll be following it closely here at Securing America, needless to say. Brad, I did want to quickly just ask you about a piece that you wrote in the aftermath of Mikhail Gorbachev, the former and final chairman of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, president of the USSR, passing last week. You ran directly against the grain of the narrative being pushed out by most people, which was that he was to be revered for having allowed the Cold War to end peaceably. Give us your alternative thesis.
Certainly, Frank. Well, Gorbachev was Andropov's protege. And Yuri Andropov was a former head of the KGB. He was ambassador to Hungary when you had the uprising in 1956, and he crushed that with as many as 20,000 Hungarian casualties in that. So he was a ruthless individual. His protege, Mikhail Gorbachev, was equally ruthless. As Andrei Gromyko said, that he may have a smile, that is, Gorbachev may have a smile, but he's got iron teeth. So what we need to recognize is that Andropov started reform in conjunction with the Soviet military and KGB because they recognized they could not compete with the United States. There was a change in warfare, what we might call revolutionary military affairs or information warfare. The Soviets could not compete with that, thus they needed to reform. However, Andropov died. You had Chernenko very briefly, a year. Then you had Andropov come in who tried to bring about the reforms that Andropov wanted. When that was not working, he went to our allies, Helmut Kohl in West Germany, to try to promise unification for neutrality, to break NATO up. He also went to the Japanese. Thankfully, we had great allies in the Cold War, in Germany, West Germany, of course, and in Japan, and they refused him. So with that, he had to make substantive changes, and essentially the issue got away from him, he was never able to step up with that. So he was America's enemy. He wanted to compete, and he wanted to defeat the United States. However, circumstances, the environment didn't let him. So it was.
I have to say, Brad, that the environment was shaped, I believe, by Ronald Reagan. Yeah. And the determined effort that he made, thanks to, and this is so relevant to today's time, in 1980, to the American people, to roll back the Soviet Union, not continue to prop it up through what was then not called engagement, but detente. And that strategy for taking it down, I think, left, as you say, Gorbachev essentially no choice but to accede to the inevitable. We're delighted that it worked out that way, needless to say, and without firing a shot. But I think credit is less due Gorbachev than Reagan by far. We didn't get to the implications of all of this for the Cold War that set in train, thanks to Deng Xiaoping thereafter. But that's for another day. Brad Thayer, thank you for your time today. Thanks for joining us. Keep up the great work at the Center for Security Policy. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to help us in doing just that, and that so equipped, and hopefully with further programs in the future, that you will go forth and multiply.